It is Monday, January 6th, 2014, and this is episode 49 of the Defensive Security Podcast. My name is Jerry Bell, and as usual, tonight we have Mr. Andrew Kellett.
Hey, is it cold enough for you?
I was going to ask you that.
Good evening.
Good Thanks evening. For having me. And as a reminder, the thoughts and opinions we express on this podcast are ours and do not represent those of our employers.
So Happy New Year, by the way.
Yes, Happy New Year.
On to 2014, new and exciting exploits and attacks.
Absolutely, and probably a lot of the same.
That's true.
So, as is usual, before Bob was detained at a border crossing, he did give me a bit of advice to pass along, and that is to take a look periodically, periodically audit the network connections on your servers. And the reason is that sometimes, especially, you know, if you're a larger shop and have, many administrators, you know, sometimes they can, create backdoors, right, after they leave. And you know, sometimes those could go for a long time without being discovered. And if you have some process in place, Bob thinks that you would maybe more quickly discover those.
I would say so. How is it going getting him released, by the way? Is that, you know, a couple weeks still, or is he going to get out?
I think he is going to get out. You know, hopefully the charges are going to get dropped.
Well, you know what they say about smuggling ferrets.
I told him about that. He wouldn't listen.
Poor ferret. Yeah.
Oh, well. So the first story we have tonight comes from Fox IT. You probably have heard something about this. I actually saw a story on my local news channel, 6 o'clock news channel today. Yahoo, their ad network, had for a period of time, starting on about December 30th through around January 3rd, had been serving up to some percentage of their visitors a redirect to the Magnitude Exploit Kit, which is all sorts of awesomeness. And in the link that I include here, which is the Fox IT blog, and apparently these are the guys that actually discovered it, they are estimating that somewhere around 27,000 computers per hour were being infected. So there were 300,000 accesses of the Magnitude Exploit Kit per hour. And yet they estimate at about a 9% uptake rate, that's about 27,000 computers per hour. And when you think about, you know, that spanning a number of days, that's a whole bunch of infected computers.
That's huge.
So, you know, the takeaway again here for me at least is that, you know, even legitimate sites have the opportunity to be malicious. And I will say furthermore, if you actually look at how these things work, if you have some kind of a working web filter in place, I think you do have a chance of catching this, right? Because it wasn't coming directly from Yahoo, right? The way it worked was Yahoo was presenting you with the ad, and embedded in the ad was an iframe. And that iframe took you to one domain, and that redirected you to another domain which had the exploit kit. And if you had the ability to blacklist or block sites that are unknown, because I think these were relatively newly registered sites, so probably not classified by any of the major web providers. If you block unclassified sites, you may have actually been okay.
Yeah, you know, the other thing I was thinking about is an ad blocker would have been very effective against this, just blocking the ad from even loading.
Absolutely.
Though that's, you know, again, relying upon the endpoint. You know, speaking of sites that have been classified in web proxies and such, I heard of an interesting technique that a pen tester was using, which is that establishing sites as known good in the various proxy server databases. So they would set up a site, you know, for, you know, fishme.com, go submit it to have them crawl it, categorize it, and then change it to malicious, which is a nasty little technique. And and it works because they don't recrawl them apparently very often.
Yeah, that's a really good point. And
yeah,
it does bypass what I just mentioned, right? So if you, you know, if you have some enterprising bad guys, they may do that, and your web filter, you know, may not catch it.
Yeah.
And
but I agree with your point. You might as well treat all sites as malicious. I also am left wondering, you know, what kind of liability does a Yahoo or anybody else who happens to not vet their ad network very closely have here, right? Do they need to be doing something to watch and see what sort of ads are being served up? I don't know, but that is, you know, it seems to me at some point Yahoo does have some level of liability here because they served it.
Yeah, I'm with you, and I'm, to be honest, I'm surprised this doesn't happen a lot more than it does, you know, because they're so pervasive. It's got to be just an extremely tempting thing for, you know, bad guys to do. And paper install is very, very profitable if you can do it on a mass scale like this. But, you know, one thing that I would say, and I know I'm, I sound like a broken record on this, but man, don't browse the web on systems that are doing important stuff, right? Because it's just so, it's so hard to block. I mean, there are so many different ways.
Do it in a VM or something. But, you know, it looks like the original exploit was via Java too. So don't know if this was, you know, older versions of Java or if these were ODs against the current version, but, you know, it doesn't tell us here, but I would say again, you know, making sure you're patched is probably a good thing. Shutting down Java is a good thing. You know, it's the same attack vector over and over again. It's funny, you know, when you first start talking about this stuff, it's once you've told the story 20 times in a row, you start to go, maybe you should turn off Java. I don't know.
Just crazy. Maybe.
Crazy talk.
It's crazy. Well, I think there's a couple of things on that. Number one is it probably was an older exploit on Java, because if you look at a lot of these, the computers running Java, I don't remember the percentages exactly, but it was something in the 80% range, at least, aren't running the current version of Java, which is really disappointing.
You know, if Oracle really gave a damn, they would have auto-update silent mechanisms.
Well, it would be much more difficult to send you the toolbar, the Ask
That's
toolbar.
True. That is true.
which you know, is very important. The other thing I was going to say is that, you know, I know this was, my data is more black hole exploit kit-centric, but there was a lot of kind of decomposition, and I suspect magnitude's not different, that, you know, the majority of exploits or majority of systems that were exploited by the black hole kit, which is now defunct, by the way, were Java, but it was not that it could only attack Java. It's just that it tried Java first because that was the most effective thing. It could also attack, you know, PDF reader and Flash and lots of other things. It's just that by volume, Java was the most likely thing to get them in, so they tried that first.
Yeah, which goes back to the point that bad guys are lazy. They'll go for the easiest win.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah.
Absolutely. So, you know, the internet's a dangerous place.
No.
Put your helmet on, kids. All right. So let's move on to the next story. This is another one that's making really big news right now. OpenSSL's website was defaced. And I actually remember seeing, I think it was Dave. What's his name? Errata Dave. He was trying to figure out what was going on, and that was actually as the site was being defaced. So,
I do remember seeing his tweets on that, and
yeah,
and
he basically, I think he was saying, "Is anybody else seeing this?" I don't think he was believing it, but anyway, OpenSSL had been defaced, and that's a really big news because OpenSSL is such a core component of so many different pieces of technology. You know, the thought that OpenSSL may be compromised is really a pretty damning thing. And as it turns out, apparently the site itself wasn't breached. It was the hypervisor. Now I want to couch that right, because there's not a lot of detail about what actually happened, right? We know the site was defaced. OpenSSL released a statement saying, you know, there was no operational problem with our site. There was no changes to the source code of OpenSSL. It was related to a hypervisor problem. And that spurred all sorts of speculation and hoopla about, well, what hypervisor was it? And in fact, VMware actually posted a blog post in response to that and essentially said, you know, there isn't a problem with our stuff, but by the way, you may want to make sure that it's properly configured, and if it's exposed to the internet, you do it the right way. And so, you know, my read on that is that their hosting provider probably wasn't doing something right.
Sounds like it. Yeah, it's, yeah. It does sound like, well, they've come out and said that there was a weak password somewhere on the hypervisor management console.
Right.
Is you know, the end story. So, you know, that's pretty straightforward, guys. Don't use weak passwords.
Well, I think the other problem I would see, maybe the bigger problem, is when you host your site in the cloud, so to speak, you know, it's not just about maintaining your site. You also have to worry about your provider, and is your provider managing things properly?
Yeah, absolutely. You are transferring liability and risk, but you're also transferring control. And, you know, what are you going to do? Are you going to assess all that? And even if you assessed it and they passed it on day one, who knows what they're going to do, you know, on day 30.
Right. You know? Or are they using weak passwords? You may be using really strong passwords, but, you mm-hmm. know, is the administrative interface to the back end of their system protected as well as what you require of yourself? And that's a tough nut.
I am thinking we need a soundboard, though, and so every time we use the word like cloud, we could play like the Microsoft "Yay Cloud," and you know, just little sound effects in the background.
Well, you know, I have been wanting to buy a soundboard, not the kind that plays cute noises, but the you know, the kind that will make the audio not suck.
But, well, there's that.
But maybe that would be, you know, the sounds would be a side benefit. So
I don't know, I might be getting too cheesy at that point.
Yeah, probably. Well, next story. This is a story from Healthcare IT News. And it's a fairly simple story. Basically, there was a health system, Riverside Health System in southeastern Virginia, has announced that they had a 4-year-long breach of PHI. And I don't think there were an incredible, actually, I think it's 919 patients' data. And it was kind of unsexy, right? This was the case where a apparently otherwise authorized person, somebody who I think was a registered nurse, was improperly accessing patients' data for a number of years. And, you know, again, this is not like, you know, we need cooler firewalls or we need better IPSs or whatever. You know, this is very basic, you know, making sure people are doing what they're supposed to be doing. And the reason I wanted to bring this one up in particular is because a lot of times I think we overlook the concept of monitoring the activity of normal everyday users. And that's especially important when you're in a regulated industry like, you know, like healthcare, where if something like this happens, you're obligated to go public and, you know, crucify yourself in front of the media. And, you know, this is this can be a bad thing. And I know it's expensive sometimes for some of these organizations. And I don't know necessarily how the economics work out. But, you know, if this group gets fined, you know, by the Office of Civil Rights, it's, you know, they probably wish they would have invested the money.
It can be anywhere from $10,000 to $50,000 per HIPAA violation.
Yeah, and I believe each of those 919 records would be a unique violation. So that's a whole bunch of money.
What I find interesting is that, according to the story, the breach, if you want to call it a breach, it's really more somebody looking at things they shouldn't have, wasn't discovered until a random company audit.
Right.
So I don't know exactly what they were looking at. In terms of the audit. But that tells me likely, I'm making an assumption here, that they were looking at audit logs of who was looking at what, and they picked it up then. And probably being done by a third party is my guess, the audit.
Right.
But I don't know for sure. And, you know, there is plenty of technical tools out there that can report on this stuff. I mean, it tells me, because they knew this was going on for 4 years and exactly 919 records, they have really good data as to what this person is looking at. So they were logging.
Yeah.
They've got all their logs.
They just weren't looking at it.
Yeah, they just weren't looking.
And by the way, I'll tell you exactly why they were looking at this. And I don't know if it was, you know, themselves or a third party, like you said. But all of us who serve the healthcare industry and work with PHI had this really nasty looming deadline of September, I think September 23rd, 2013, when the new HIPAA mega rule came into effect. And a lot of organizations were really scrambling around to figure out where they stood because, you know, basically, you know, the bell had rung that at some point you were going to get audited by the government and it wasn't going to be pretty. So I think a lot of organizations were out figuring out, you know, what does their house look like? And I would suspect that this was probably found as a result of that kind of prep work.
Yeah, it's interesting. Maybe we'll get some more details, but 4 years is a long time.
Yes. Yes. Well, but, you know, interestingly, it's not necessarily out of step when you look at like the DBIR. You know, you see quite often multiple year durations between, you know, the start and detection is not uncommon.
So the other stat I thought was really interesting, last line of the article, which is out of more than the 80,000 HIPAA breach cases OCRs received since 2003, only 17 of them have resulted in fines.
Yeah. Yeah.
So, I mean, I do expect that to go up dramatically now that the law has changed and has more teeth, but that really is a neutered law that has no teeth and, you know, very little enforcement that would really scare anybody.
So far, and I agree with that as a looking backwards statement. What is entirely unclear is how active they're going to be going forward.
Yeah, agreed.
You know, I'll tell you, I know I've got a number of friends who are attorneys, and it's really going to be very interesting to see how some of these things get litigated.
Yeah. Yeah, and yeah, I'd love to know what their decision criteria of what they go to a fine and what they don't, right? In negligence, maliciousness, you know, what sort of things are they looking for that makes that determination? And it'd be interesting to watch over the next year or two how many fines actually get issued.
Yeah, absolutely. I do know that there is I think it's, if I recall, actually says it in the article, I think it was $10,000 per violation. I'm sorry.
Yeah, it's $50,000 fine for violation due to willful neglect that goes uncorrected.
Right.
And $10,000 per violation due to willful neglect where the violation is properly addressed.
There you go.
So to me, the way I read that, and not being a HIPAA expert, is, you know, you have a breach and you fix it, you only get 1/5 the fine.
Right.
You know, for some reason, I'm not sure what kind of time frames they have, but if it doesn't get corrected, it's $50,000. So I don't know how anyone could ever not be corrected, but that's the way the law is written.
Yeah. Now I know, and this is one thing that really has yet to kind of work itself out, is one of the big changes that came along with the mega rule change was proactive auditing. And so previously, you know, HHS and OCR did not do any auditing. And so it was basically just, you know, on the honor system, you would come forward and declare yourself, you declare your violations or what have you. But now they're actually going out and doing audits. And there were a number of I think what they called a pilot audits, and they were run by some of the big four consulting firms. And there were some really big fines levied, and I think everyone, if I'm not mistaken.
Yeah, it's going to get interesting. I think HIPAA is going to get a lot more active as a concern going forward for a lot of folks.
Here's one thing I have, and this is probably getting more philosophical than the podcast needs, right? But I don't understand the dichotomy, the rift between PHI and other forms of personal data, right? You know, we now have this regime in place where we're going to heavily punish people when they disclose PHI. But is that honestly any worse than a social security number or a credit card number?
I would argue yes. If it gets leaked to the world that you have AIDS, you can never unleak that.
Yeah, that's fair.
If that's fair. You know, if it gets leaked to the world that you have, you know, herpes, you know, I there's always been that doctor-patient confidentiality, and there's always been that sort of, you know, concept of that. So when we start making electronic records, I can understand why there is this built-in expectation of privacy, which was never built into some of the other segments of our, you know, commerce, sadly.
Yep. No, you're right. I guess I was thinking it more myopically from the perspective of fraud type activities and not from a, you know, reputation, personal damage type thing. So
yeah, you know,
good point.
The way I see HIPAA is really designed in many, many ways is, you know, celebrity X comes into the hospital and, you know, whatever, right? You know, somebody's celebrity's child B is being treated for something. You know, not that we as normal people aren't also entitled to privacy, but I think that's where the big dollars would be in breaching that information.
Yeah.
You know, not that it doesn't get leaked anyway, but.
True. Although, interestingly, you only have to report if you have over 500 records breached.
Hmm.
So, you know, there's nothing perfect in this, right?
It's interesting, not to go slightly off topic, but speaking of medical stuff, you know, Twitter has been all ablaze in the security community about the tox records and cause of death released for Barnaby Jack.
Yep.
And it's interesting, you know. I didn't know him. I think I met him once, so, you know, I don't really have a dog in this hunt. But at the same time, people like information and like facts, right? And you know, I guess I equated a little bit to reading airplane accident reports. There's a weird sort of macabre interest amongst pilots of reading accident reports. We want to know why that plane crashed, so we can avoid it, as you know. So I don't know. I'm taking this way off topic here, but it is, you know, something within the security community, and a lot of people are very offended that that information got released and feel like it's disparaging to the individual. And obviously, I'm not saying it because I don't want to perpetuate it, what the cause of death was, but a lot of people were upset that information got out there. I don't know, facts are facts, I guess, but I don't know. What do you think? I'm sort of
situation.
Yeah.
I mean, there's really nothing good that can come about it. I know there's been a lot of discussion about how, you know, the community has been the security community, that is, has been very focused on, you know, things like suicide and and burnout and things like that because of some of the recent things. You know, we've seen a number of suicides. That wasn't the case with Barnaby, but, you know, and so I think there's a recognition that there's a lot of problems, and you know, we gotta get better about, if we're going to do that, right? We've got to get better about recognizing more broad problems.
Yeah, so. Yeah. I think if I had a more personal connection with the gentleman, I probably would, you know, have a stronger feeling about it. But
yep, nope. I'm with you.
But it is interesting watching the reaction.
Yeah. Well, I think he touched a lot of people. I think he was
you
very
mean, you
well.
Mean not in the way the judge tells me I'm not allowed to touch people.
Not that way.
Okay. Checking.
Not in the naughty way. I meant I think he was a pretty significant role model for a lot of people in the industry. And so, you know, seeing something like this is, you know, kind of an affront, I guess.
Plus, he had a kick-ass name. I think that's half of it.
Absolutely.
I need to get a better kick-ass name.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, let's move on to happier things like Target. All
right. Oh, yeah, Target. Yes, happy, happy.
Yes. So, you know, I think we're all very well aware of what is going on at Target. But it's interesting to see some of the fallout starting to happen as a result of Target. And one of the articles comes from the Credit Union Times. And this is an article about the Alabama State Employees Credit Union has filed a lawsuit against Target. And in that lawsuit, they claim that Target was not complying with the requirements of PCI. And I find that extremely interesting because I don't know how they would know that.
Yeah, this is so premature. You know, quote, amongst other things, merchants are prohibited from storing unprotected, this is the complaint, unprotected cardholder data, cardholder information. The stolen data includes all this cardholder information. There is no legitimate reason for Target to have kept all this information stored electronically. There's about seven different ways I can think of for a bad guy to get this information without Target having stored it unencrypted. Yeah, unless the lawyer for the Alabama State Employee Credit Union, which, by the way, is one of my favorite state employee credit unions, I will say, in my top three, unless they know a whole lot more than we know, this seems awfully premature.
Yeah.
Now, that being said, you know, they say, quote, plaintiff has lost significantly in refunding the unauthorized use and access of its customers and members' accounts due to Target data breach. And I get that, right? The cost in refunding lost deposits, time, resources spent to remedy the situation of plaintiff's customers and members are untold. Well, it can't be untold. You're going to have to quantify it. Sorry, that's the law. And you can quantify it, believe me. That's just lawyer speak. That being said, I don't disagree that Target may be liable for the direct costs incurred. And this is where it starts to get interesting.
It really is because, you know, what is this? This starts to open up some really hairy things like due care and commercially reasonable security. And, you know, how do you, based on what do you judge whether or not Target has sufficient security? I go around about this.
I know. Let's create a standard called PCI. No, but seriously, right? And do they meet the standard? Because at some point, this actually comes back to the card processors, right? Not the processor, but the card holders. Not the card holders. The card issuers
right.
of Visa, MasterCard, American Express, whomever else. End of the day, the shrink is somewhat their problem. And they're the ones who really have to absorb the loss. So for them, they're protecting themselves by saying, all right, if you want to process credit cards, here's the minimum level of security you must put in place so that we're not having unacceptable level of losses. So at the end of the day, if Target met that minimum level of security, and let's assume for the moment they did, only one of two things can occur. Either the card issuers are going to say, well, you didn't, even though you did, so we're going to hold you liable for it somehow. Or they're going to say, yep, you did. I guess we better update PCI for this new attack vector. And, you know, I guess they're going to eat the loss. But in the meantime, there is a lot of intangibles here that these other organizations are rightfully, in my mind, trying to figure out who's going to cover.
Yeah. Yeah.
But I don't know if Target's the right people to sue yet. I don't know. It could be the PCI Council because their PCI spec is too weak. I don't know.
Right. There's more that we don't know than we do know at this point. And you know, this particular article was really quite frustrating. And I think in there they said something. I'm trying to find the exact quote about trying to push Target to improve their firewalls.
Right. That yeah.
Which, you know, is extraordinarily simplistic in most every way. So you know, I don't know if some of this was talking points, but you know, here's one quote, right? The stolen data includes, among other things, customer names, credit and debit card numbers, card expiration dates, and the three-digit security codes located on the back of the cards, which is false. You know, unequivocally false.
Not magnetic track data, is it?
Right.
Yeah, sorry.
There's two CVV numbers.
Yeah.
And this has been a real big problem. And I know I'm probably being overly pedantic here, right? But I've seen this banted about a lot, right? The CVV number that is on the back of your card number is not encoded in the magnetic stripe. And Target did not retain that printed number on the back of your card. It's a very important distinction because it's one of the things that will tell whether or not the card is present. And it also is going to make those cards very difficult to use online. And so right. One of the reasons when you read Brian Krebs, you know, number of articles about this, the way they are parceling out these credit card numbers is really based on geography. They're trying to sell these cards to people who are geographically located where, you know, around where the people who have the cards are. That way you don't have to, you know, try to buy the things online because everybody uses the CVV as a, you know, an online anti-fraud right. thing. And so anyway, I'm just
no, it's
frustrated.
Important. I mean, we are here to be factually accurate as best we can. So, you know, our listeners want this level of detail so that we can, you know, kind of counter some of the fluff out there.
Yeah. And what we'll see, the other thing is, going back to one of their statements, among other things, merchants are prohibited from storing unprotected cardholder information. So, you know, we know that their cardholder information is encrypted, right? What is the definition of unprotected?
Yeah.
That's, you know, I wonder how this is going to play out. This could potentially be an extraordinarily eye-opening set of court cases if it proceeds through. I mean, these may be withdrawn or settled out of court or who knows what, but you know, some of these definitions would be really interesting to see, to see vetted in a court of law. I hate seeing it happen this way, but I'm kind of morbidly curious.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, this may go nowhere, but it'll be interesting to watch.
So, well,
and this is not the end of it. I mean, this is the first of many.
Absolutely. As I recall, and this is only one, but I believe there are four other lawsuits that have been filed, including one who is which is trying to get class status, filed by a lady, and I should go dig up the article and include it in the show notes. But one of the other lawsuits was filed by a lady who had not had her card or had not incurred any fraudulent charges on her card.
Awesome.
And but she was filing this lawsuit in anticipation that she might suffer damages.
I love it. Which, you know what? That is my new business model. I'm just going to start suing everybody I can in anticipation that someday they may somehow harm me.
Oh my God. So I'm sure this is totally, totally unrelated to Target. Totally.
In another isolated incident.
A totally isolated incident. I can't imagine in any way this is related to Target. The U.S. CERT has issued an advisory about malware on point of sale systems. Huh. And they talk about the everybody's favorite malware called Dexter, which is just a fantastic piece of malware. Whoever created that is an evil genius in every sense of the word. And apparently there's a new variant, which I had not heard of, called Stardust. And I guess Stardust is to network traffic what Dexter is to POS memory, in-memory stuff.
Though in theory, we're not supposed to be saying that stuff unencrypted anyway, but...
In theory.
Right.
Yeah, and that does lead me to wonder, you know, how that is working. And, you know, I suspect every single retailer implements their stuff a little bit differently. You know, I have no particular insight about any particular retailer, but, you know, I found it kind of coincidental that this advisory came out, you know, on I think it was the 2nd of January. And if I work backwards and I account for the inefficiency of government, you know, the gears probably started turning right about the date that the Target breach was announced.
Pure coincidence.
I'm sure it's coincidence. It's got to be. It's got to be. All right. But, you know, if you are a retailer and you're not up on this sort of stuff, you know, it's at your own peril.
Yeah, the solutions that they put in here were kind of interesting. You know, change off your default passwords. Yeah, use strong passwords when you change them. Update POS software applications. I got to wonder on that one, how often people actually update their POS. You know, there's a risk when you do a patch, right? And a lot of people may treat these like appliances that don't need to be updated.
Especially if you got a bunch of them, and let's say you're, you know, right in the run up to Christmas.
Yeah, yeah. Well, sure. Anybody in retail or anybody in sales has a network freeze typically at the beginning of November, and nothing can change. Right. Nothing until like January 15th, typically. Install a firewall. Okay, that's nice. And then what?
Well, policy, you know, as we've learned, right, just having that firewall is...
use antivirus. Well, okay. Is your POS gear custom? Can it run antivirus?
Yeah, is your variant of Dexter detected?
Right.
Detectable?
Restrict access to the internet. Okay, I can get on board with that. And disallow remote access. Okay, I can get on board with that. I don't know. I would have added in here, have network monitoring to detect anomalous behavior.
Yes, absolutely.
that's the one I would have added.
I definitely 100% agree with that.
Much easier said than done, of course, but you got to try.
I think... quite a few of these have been fairly common. I guess the remote access one is pretty common, where attackers are jumping on Wi-Fi networks and hitting RDP up on these Windows POS terminals. So, you know, that's probably a good one. What frightened me was the implication that people might be browsing the internet from a POS terminal. And
yeah,
if it's not entirely clear, you know, based on the history of things that I've talked about, I think that's a really bad freaking idea.
I don't think I'm not sure you're clear.
Yeah, don't check email. Don't browse the internet. You know, if you have a POS terminal, use it as a POS terminal. Don't use it as anything else, because guess what? It's going to get popped. And you're going to be on the news.
All right, well, let's take this for a second. Let's make a couple of assumptions here. Because we don't know, right? This is purely speculation. Target has custom or at least uniquely developed POS.
Okay.
Malware attacked and was resident on that POS.
Right.
Therefore, that malware was probably custom written for Target.
Potentially. I'll explain why. Right. While Target may have hypothetically wrote their own custom POS, they probably didn't write a custom operating system. So the custom part of their custom POS is probably the application.
Okay.
And it's probably running on a Linux or a Windows.
All right. Let's say I agree with you. I'm not saying I do, but let's say I agree with you. Because, you know.
Touché.
No, but seriously, you're right, right? Okay, so let's say this is just for the sake of argument, a memory scraper.
Right.
That's grabbing this information out of memory.
Which is what Dexter is, by the way.
Right. How, you know, memory space is huge. So I'm not a coder, but, you know, I used to mess with it a long time ago. If I'm looking for specific bits of memory, you know, I could do a search for it, but that's very, very, very time intensive. I got to find out some way to know where that data is living in memory on a regular and constantly changing basis. So, I mean, sure, right? You could probably write code that would say, okay, I want to watch when my POS fires up and watch for certain calls and then see where it puts this data, and then I know it's there. Look, I'm getting in way over my head in this discussion. But the point is, it's not as simple as there's not a routine I can call in C++ that says, get cardholder data out of memory. I got to know where it lives, right?
No, it's not that simple, but it isn't as difficult as it might seem.
All right. Well, all that being said, I don't know how any of these would have stopped this chain of supposition that I've laid out, that this malware got out there. That's in the cert notice.
Right. Well, I think there, you know, again, assuming all of our hypotheses are correct here, you know, we don't know how it got there in the first place.
Correct. Right? We don't know the initial infection vector.
Because, you know, let's just say, we have, it could not be their POS at all, right? But let's just say, you know, a company like Target had a very widespread piece of malware on their POS systems. You know, in this particular case, it was either a majority or all of their 1,800 stores in the U.S. You know, that's not like somebody running around with a USB drive.
Right.
You know, that is like, you know, somebody packaged it up in the, you know, in the tarball that gets pushed out in their in their management, you know, their code management system or something
somehow
like that.
Self-propagating or something. Yeah.
Right. I mean, you know, there's so many ways, right? It could it could have a really flat network and it propagated using MS-06 or 08067, you know. Who knows? Right? We don't know. But I agree with you. The only one that I would say that potential, has the potential, is if you were to in some way isolate those POS terminals from talking to the internet.
Well, that might have stopped the exfiltration. That's one thing we don't know about, right? Because 41 million records, although it's relatively small data, still that adds up.
Yeah.
We don't know where it resided. We don't know if it was immediately exfiltrated or trickled out or put in a batch file center. We don't know how it got out.
Right.
Right, once captured. So, yeah, maybe that would have been a fact. Well, I think it's good advice regardless, right? You want to limit your outbound connectivity.
Right. Well, I think the point is, if you know, no matter what kind of environment you're in, is to really think logically about how could this happen, right? What are the vectors? How could it get in? How am I going to stop it from getting in? And if it's in, how am I going to detect it? And if I don't detect it, how am I going to stop it from getting out?
Right.
And you know, that's.
And the assumption being that if this was a direct exfiltration from every device, and that's a big assumption here, watching for your POS systems trying to talk to the internet might have been a good indicator of compromise.
Absolutely.
But it's easier for us to play, you know, Monday morning quarterback.
Especially when we have no idea what the hell actually happened.
So basically we've wasted the last 10 minutes on complete wild speculation.
Well, I think the point more is about the thought process, you know, because, you know, again, the whole point here is thinking about how we need to improve to protect our environment, right? And every environment's different. You know, there aren't going to be any two environments that are the same. And so I think it's more a matter of figuring out the logical constructs that need to be considered when you have an environment that you're trying to protect.
Yeah.
So, all right.
We beat that one to the ground, I think.
We beat that one to death. All right. The next article comes from Forbes, and this is on the heels of Target also. And the title is 7 Ways to Protect Yourself Against a Data Breach. And, you know, keeping in mind that this is an article in Forbes, the intended audience is more of a business person.
And SMB space, I believe.
Yeah, entrepreneur type of person. And, you know, there's a lot of fluff, but they do have 7 recommendations, and I wanted to talk about those. Number 1, you should always make sure your customer data is stored in an encrypted database. Yes, because that is the only place that customer data can be lifted from.
Absolutely.
We didn't just spend 15 minutes talking about.
And here's the fun part, right? That I really, really drives me crazy. All right, let's say I do that and I encrypt my database. What am I truly protecting against at that moment in time when I'm encrypting data at rest?
Right. Stealing the hard drives?
Right.
Well, you know, that's an interesting thing. And I got into a discussion with, some important person, some hoity-toity person.
Wait, a not name drop.
Yeah, sorry. You know, it was actually about Target and their pins, right? Because they announced that Target announced that they lost their encrypted pins. And, you know, there was a bunch of hoopla. How could that happen? And oh my God, it was triple DES. And I think we talked about this last time. But anyway, you know, the point is that there are some ways and some more specialized systems where you have a hardware, HSM, hardware security module, where you can store data encrypted, and you do have some flexibility to, you know, to have it encrypted at the field level.
Sure.
And, you know, and you leverage the HSM to decrypt it for you. And even if you get access to the tables directly, you still don't have the ability to decrypt them unless you.
And a much better, more sophisticated way of doing that. But if I follow this guy's advice alone, I could just have a self-encrypting hard drive, and that buys me almost nothing.
Well, I'll tell
because
you.
Because I could just come in over the network, and oh, look, it happily decrypts it for the operating system.
You're on an excellent point. You're on a great point, because most companies, especially in the SMB space, are not going to be able to afford a mainframe with an HSM, you know, which is a, you know, 6 or 7 digit thing. And, you know, most are going to do exactly what you said, which is going to protect against the hard drive being stolen, or they're going to actually, you know, turn on Oracle table encryption, and in their application, they're going to have the decryption key, because it's, you know, it's symmetric encryption. And so, you know, whoever's popped their system just has to go rooting through the code and find the password, which, you know, is
now, that being said, if this is a laptop, yes, encrypt the hard drive.
Absolutely.
Right.
Absolutely. But the attack vectors are totally different, because, you know, you don't generally, and now I will tell you, I have seen problems where hard drives go missing from a data center, and, you know, that that's a whole ugly thing.
It can happen,
but,
sure.
But, you know, by far, laptop hard drives being stolen physically and is a big risk, and so you want to encrypt those, no question about it. The big problem with servers is, you know, access from the application layer. And that stuff is transparently decrypted. And I have crossed swords on a number of occasions with the compliance minded people who said the data had to be encrypted, and therefore you had to have your server drives encrypted because that was going to protect your data. You know, and I eventually gave up, right? But, you know, hey, so if I'm a bad guy and I log into the server and the data is, you know, decrypted on the fly for me, what did I, you know, other than a whole lot of headaches, what did I buy?
Yeah, exactly. And that's just the one thing that always gets under my skin, is understand what encryption does and doesn't do and how you implement it. That's all I'm saying.
Right. Yeah. And one of the reasons I wanted to talk about this is that these are they're at a high level, they seem like good ideas, but they're very nuanced.
Yeah.
They're very nuanced. And if you don't understand what you're doing, you know, you could potentially be worse off, because you've got a false sense of security. So we've only gone through one. The next suggestion, you should have multiple levels of passwords to access any database storing customer information and change these passwords frequently. You know, I'm not going to argue with that. I mean, that's a good, you know, good idea. Two-factor would be better.
Yeah.
Number three, you should periodically and regularly run background checks on your employees handling customer data.
And what is that going to do exactly?
Well,
I would rather replace that with regularly audit their behavior in the environment and look at the logs of what they're accessing.
I'm with you there. Absolutely. I mean, it is a little it's
okay,
a little
so
unfortunate.
Periodically run background checks. Sorry, I didn't mean to step on you there. Yep. But so what are you going to find? That suddenly they now are in massive debt. Their FICO score has gone through the floor. And so they're more likely to steal and sell your data, like, because of financial problems. They've been recently convicted of a felony, yet still showed up to work every day. I mean, what are you hoping to find in a background check that you didn't when you hired them?
I think there's an overly simplistic association of people who, you know, who have a criminal record or who have done bad things in one area of their life will, you know, have a presumption of doing it somewhere else.
Well, why didn't you pick that up on the initial background check before you hired? Well, this is saying is periodically and regularly run background checks during employment.
Yes. Yes.
Absolutely. I see no value there.
I see dubious value, right? I'm with your point for the most part. I think, unfortunately, given some of my experience, I've seen people go bad, and
sure.
But at the same time, I think you have the right idea, right? That it, you know, it is much more about people's behavior, because, you know, it isn't whether or not somebody now has a criminal record that's a problem to you. It's whether they're doing something bad on your systems right. that's a problem to you.
I 100% agree that, you know, if somebody suddenly goes bad in the environment, you need to know that. Like if somebody suddenly gets addicted to drugs, right, you need to know that. But that's not the kind of stuff that's going to show up in a background check.
Right.
You know? At least not the current version. Maybe the NSA's version. So, Bob, I see your habit for dwarf porn has increased dramatically lately.
What's tentacle porn again? Oh, my goodness. I think your point is valid. It's much more about the activity of the person and not about what you'll find in a background check. Because if you're relying only on background checks, you're not going to find the person who, you know, who doesn't have a criminal record or hasn't been caught yet, or,
right.
you know, their criminal background will be, you know, in the future after they are arrested for robbing you blind, you know.
Or they made a mistake 10 years ago and they're not going to do it again.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, that kind of presumes that people can't be reformed.
Right.
That is a little irritating. But anyway, next one. You should make sure you have malware detection software running on both your servers, hosted or not, and workstations, and ensure your firewalls are up and secure. Ow, ow, right. ow, my head. Ow. It's AV, people. You know, if somebody wants to steal your data, they're not going to send a virus that Symantec can detect, okay? So it doesn't matter if you have your AV up to date or not. I'm sorry.
I have a question.
Irritates the hell out of me.
I have a question.
Go ahead.
How do I know if my firewall is secure?
The light blinks, doesn't it?
Thank you. I'll go now.
All right. Next one. You should review and implement the standard network security health check controls, like the one suggested here. And when you click the one suggested here, it takes you to some, I don't even know where.
Oh, no, it's fun. It's AVG, yeah. Small Business IT Security Health Check. I played with it for a while today. It's actually not bad. It actually is not bad. So it asks you questions like, do you limit access to data within your company, designate trusted employees, and adopt a strict need-to-know policy? And you get questions like yes, no, don't know, or answers. Do you educate employees on data security policy and procedures? Have you determined which members of staff should be trusted? You know, it's actually not bad. It actually has some decent stuff in here. But what's funny is when you go through this entire process, it just ranks you on how many yeses and nos and don't nos you have, and, you know, basically says, wow, you suck at security. You should buy some more AVG product.
clearly that's going to solve the problem right there.
The questions themselves are not bad. There's 17 questions, and I actually agree with most of them. They're articulate. They're well thought out. And they're decent. Now, mind you, it doesn't tell you a whole lot, but you know, here's a question. Like, do you routinely destroy unneeded information, such as shredding old paper files, physically destroying old hard drives, wiping portable devices, removing and destroying any memory or SIM cards in your smartphones and other devices you dispose of or sell? Not bad, right? Very yeah. specific question. You know, have you ensured that third-party partners and vendors have proper security procedures in place? Not bad. Have you considered restricting web surfing on company computers and smartphones, or distribute a list of off-limits high-risk websites or web categories? I don't agree with distributing a list, because that'll just tell them to go there. Have you created a data breach notification policy, which is a document you provide to all of your customers telling them how your business will notify them such a breach? Have you created an internal incident response plan for dealing with breaches and post-breach notification? Right? I mean, it's good questions. Do you know the law on data security notifying customers about a breach? So, you know, I'd recommend, I like the questions. I just, you know,
yeah.
Most of it's.
Yep.
So, anyway.
Interesting. I didn't go through the questions. I wasn't as
obviously.
Yeah, I know.
That's all right. You've read a lot of the like 500-page documents that I've skipped, so you know. I'm up on one for you. That's it.
All right. The next one. You should make sure you have a disaster plan. In parentheses, you have one, right? And that has a plan for if a breach occurs. Boy, that's some really bad English there. But anyway, the point there is making sure that you account for data breaches in your DR plan, which I think is a good thing. And I know, it's really important not to skimp on the DR plan when it comes to that sort of thing, right? Because I know in particular, DR plans tend to be kind of loosey-goosey, and you can expose yourself if something bad happens. So, I think there's kind of two ways to read that. Number one is make sure you've got data breach protection, in quotes, kind of factored into your DR plan, but also that potentially you might use your DR plan as a response to a data breach. So, you know, you can kind of go either way with that. I can see value in both ways. And then finally, you should have your attorney update your terms and conditions to hold you harmless in the event of a stolen data incident. And in parentheses, although that still can't stop anyone from suing you, comma, you losing that suit, or at the very least suffering the same lack of credibility and reputation issues. So, you know, basically update your T's and C's, but it's really not going to save you.
Yep.
So that is the end of our stories. We're over an hour already. Holy moly.
Who picks these stories anyway?
I don't know. I'm sorry. So, have you read anything good lately?
I'm reading. I just finished the sequel to The Shining by Mr. Stephen King, called Dr. Sleep, which follows little Danny Torrance as he's an adult and his adventures later in life. It's pretty decent. That was my vacation read. Blew through pretty quick. And now I'm reading a really heavy book on really hardcore weather information for pilots. It's called Weather Flying, and it's very deep and very analytical and teaching me a lot more about weather than I had any idea existed. So,
cool.
That's my current very exciting reading. And nice. I feel like you asked me this question, so I could ask you. Hey, Jerry, what have you read lately?
Well, no, I'm actually reading a book about business strategy. It's I took a break from security books.
Nice.
So this book is called Analysis Without Paralysis, and I'll tell you, it's really cool. As I've been reading it, I keep thinking about back to security, right? And mm-hmm. and how security ties to business strategy and needs to be better about supporting business strategy. So, you know, one of the things I wanted to mention was sometimes it's good to get out of the IT bubble.
Yeah.
Because at the end of the day, we are here to support business, not to be secure, right? We're here because our companies need us to secure them so they can transact business.
You know, I did some commercial flying recently. Went up to Michigan to see some family, and as I was going through the TSA security checkpoint waiting for my Freedom Group, I saw their sign, and their sign read that our priority is your safety. Right? That is their number one priority.
Mike Rowe had something to say about that at one point.
Absolutely. Safety third. And for the record, I love Mike Rowe and I love Dirty Jobs. He's an excellent human being. I thought about this statement that my safety is their number one priority. And I quickly concluded this was entire bullshit. And I think Penn and Teller, if they could resurrect their show, bullshit, would do an excellent episode on this. My security is not their concern. They couldn't care less about my security. If that was their only priority, their number one priority, they would shut down aviation because they would incur zero risk. So their actual priority is to allow commercial aviation to exist and enable it by establishing enough trust in the system that the average passenger feels reasonably secure.
Yeah, yep.
And then when I got really radical, I said, no government agency's first priority should be my safety and security, ever. All government agencies' first priority in my highly radical mind should be the protection of my rights, should be their first priority.
Maybe the fire department.
Because if you start turning things around and looking at them that way, right, look at your encounters with the police department. And mind you, I'm a big supporter of the police department, but I'm also a big supporter of my rights. That entire interaction is dictated based on a set of rights and principles, right, as a protection of your rights because of the concept that it may go to court.
Yeah, yep.
Right. So all the sorts of laws, and even though the cops can sort of, you know, you need to be knowledgeable about what your rights are in those situations. So if you look at it this way, if you took every government agency and you encapsulated it with the concept of their number one priority is to maintain and respect the rights of the constituents of the United States, you know, of the not the constituents, but the, you know, the populace of the United States. Think how that would change their mission statement. And since they are government, they in theory serve us. It seems like that should be their number one priority, not my safety or my security. Because frankly, my rights are more important to me than my safety and security. Because I always am trading off my safety and security to do things all the time.
I know we're way off topic, but I'll tell you,
feel free to edit this out of the show.
I think as a civilization almost, and maybe it's just the U.S., we've gotten to the point where, especially the leadership, has this "not on my watch," mentality, where you know it has become morally preferable to violate civil rights, or I use that term loosely, right?
Mm-hmm.
To set aside civil rights for the sake of security. And I think one of the frustrating parts is for all of us, especially in this kind of line of work, because we think about this stuff all day, is, you know, it's not actually trading off civil rights or liberties for security. It's trading them off for security theater.
Right.
And it's not even accomplishing the goal that they're purporting to.
Mature society, we would be saying, hey, traveling public, we can't reduce risk to zero, but here's what we can do under the law, and it reduces it this much on average.
Yeah, there was somebody, this was shortly after September 11th, maybe 2002, somebody did where I read this or who wrote it, but somebody did an analysis that said that the TSA would be far, if they really cared about saving lives, the TSA would be far better off performing prostate exams at the checkpoints, because they would save way more lives than they could ever save.
Yeah.
You know, by protecting airplanes.
Right.
And you know, it's the way it is. Where we as a society are a bunch of pansies.
It's true.
We're babies.
We didn't used to be this way.
No. And you know, by the way, if you're not interested in this, you can there's not going to be any more infosec stuff. So
yeah,
you can stop. Feel free. But you know, do you remember a couple weeks ago when Nelson Mandela passed away? There was lots of heads of state flew to South Africa to visit the funeral. I was watching, and I personally really don't like the show, but my wife loves GMA, Good Morning America. And they were having an absolute cow at the lack of security in South Africa, and how, you know, there weren't snipers everywhere, and how, you know, I don't know, the guy who was doing the sign language, the interpretation, you know, how could he have possibly gotten that close to the president? You know, it boggled my mind to think that, you know, that's the media perception now. And, you know, one interesting thing is, and I've read a couple of books now by Dan Ariely, which are kind of, they're behavioral economics, but they're kind of, you know, psychological books that, you know, people's perception on things can be guided. And it's really interesting how our society is changing as time goes on. And, you know, I don't know if it's a, you know, if this is just the way it's going to be forevermore, or if we will go back to where we were. I don't know, but it's really interesting. And I feel bad for future generations, because I you know, I don't think, particularly at the rate of change that we're seeing now, I feel really bad for my kids and their kids.
I feel bad for your kids too.
Well, I know. I mean, that's for a different reason, because they have terrible parents, or at least a terrible dad.
Well, you know, this reminds me so much of an essay written by a man by the name of Jeff Cooper, who is now passed away, but he was a very famous Marine and firearms instructor. Started a gun site in Las Vegas, which is a very famous gunfighting school. And he wrote an essay called Hold Enough, and I believe he published it in 1998. And, you know, it's well worth reading. You can Google it and find it in a heartbeat. It's only a couple of paragraphs. But it in essence, talks about this exact topic at a national level. You know, why he opens with, why do you suppose the creeps of the world have declared open season on Americans? You know, are we not the posterity of Patrick Henry and George Washington and Nathan Hale and Buck Travis and George Custer and Teddy Roosevelt and George Patton? And he says, we seem to have changed, and not for the better. You know, basically, you know, he goes on to say that people feel like they can have a free ticket to life, a life without fighting, and that it was not prevalent in the 20s or the 30s. It's new and now almost universal. And he talks about hijacking. He talks about how, you know, and he calls bad guys goblins in his parlance. You know, the issue is hijacking, air piracy. It's now intolerable, and it promises to get worse. We wring our hands. We look for solutions and concepts and gadgets. But what we need is will. And he says the goblins do not attack or hijack El Al, which is the Israeli national airline. Not anymore. And the Shiites wanted their people back from Israeli POW camps. Their obvious target was an Israeli airplane, one might suppose. But they hit TWA instead. Why? Because they believe correctly that Americans will not fight, and that also correctly, Americans will grovel at the possibility that other Americans may be killed. You know, and I'm skipping some here, but the press, academy, and law enforcement establishes preach, do not fight back. On the street, in your home, on the airplane, on the high seas, anywhere, anytime, do not fight back. You may be hurt. Of course you may be hurt. You may be killed. As my daughter put it just last week, big deal. You expect to live forever? You know, and this is kind of the last point I'll make on this. He says, 50 years ago, young people were made to understand around the dinner table that strife was part of life, and that they might well encounter it, and it would then be their duty to face it without blinking, ready, willing, and able to use force quickly and expertly if necessary. Boys were taught to shoot and use their hands, and girls were taught to respect that in their men. And that society was infinitely safer and more serene than what we have now. So
there you have it.
Yeah, I know. Hell of a downer. But it goes to this concept, though. It does. And, you know, and it's a pretty interesting essay.
All right. Well, I mean, maybe next time we can talk about gun control. I kid. So anyway, I appreciate those that have hung in. Andy and I are feel pretty strongly about this. Probably more Andy than I, but there you have it. So anyhow, I definitely appreciate everyone listening. It is always a pleasure to run this podcast. And as usual, if you have any ideas or feedback or what have you, send us an email to info@defensivesecurity.org. We definitely love hearing from listeners. You can hit us up on Twitter @DefensiveSec. You can even find us on Facebook, although I will tell you I'm pretty bad about checking the Facebook messages. So you can find the links to the stories we talk about in our show notes on the website at www.defensivesecurity.org. And if you find this podcast useful, tell a friend, give us a rating on iTunes. And with that, I bid you adieu for another week. Take care, Mr. Callett.
You too. Good night.
Good night.